This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Haitians refuse to accept what they say is yet another rigged election to keep the country under foreign occupation. East Aleppo is finally liberated from U.S.-backed jihadists in what Syrians call the biggest hostage rescue in history. And Black activist Ramona Africa talks about the roots of her politics of resistance.
But first, for more than half a century, criminal justice reform advocates have pushed for community review boards to investigate and punish police brutality. It is commonly accepted that these review boards are toothless unless they have the power to subpoena witnesses. However, police unions are seeking a court injunction against Newark, New Jersey's Civilian Complaint Review Board, established by Black Mayor Raz Baraka. The People's Organization for Progress, POP, has a seat on the review board. POP Chairman Larry Hamm isn't surprised that the cops want to shut the board down.
The only surprise was that I didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but the union, the FOP, Fraternal Order of Police, and the SOA, the Superior Officers Association, representatives had said from the beginning that they were opposed to this and that they would fight it. So when somebody tells you they're going to fight something, you know, you better put your fist up and be ready to respond to the first punch. So they went into court. And this poses a real challenge because if the review board doesn't have the subpoena powers and investigatory powers, then it really cannot be an effective police review board. I hope when the city goes into court, that is the city of Newark, asking that the injunction be lifted, I hope they're able to persuade the judge to do so.
Well, what could your response be? We know that this board is legally a creature of the mayor created by executive order. So what legally could be the response of folks like POP, which has a representative on the board, and other community organizations?
Well, initially, yes, the police review board was created through an executive order of the mayor. But since then, an ordinance has been passed by the city council. So it does have a dimension of permanency to it. If it was only executive order, then the next mayor could discontinue it or would issue another executive order to continue it. The city council, about a year after the mayor issued an executive order, passed an ordinance for a police review board. But this poses a real challenge for POP. I mean, suppose the outcome is not positive in court. Suppose the bottom line, after all the arguments have been made and after all the appeals have been made, the city is told that it doesn't have the legal authority to imbue any city agency with subpoena powers and investigatory powers. See, this is the argument that the FOP and the SOA is making, that the city of Newark does not have the legal authority to empower an agency with subpoena power, that is something that must be granted by the state legislature. And so what really needs to happen right now, whoever represents the city of Newark and parts of it in the state legislature, they need to be approached to be asked now to put bills in. See, this is a first for the state of New Jersey. The state of New Jersey has never had a police board with subpoena and investigatory powers. So the legal infrastructure has not been developed for that yet. Anticipating a negative ruling from the judge would compel leadership to go to the state legislators and the state senators that represent Newark and say, look, you guys need to put in some legislation that will enable they couldn't just do it for the city of Newark. They would have to pass legislation that would enable municipalities to create police review boards with subpoena power. That needs to happen. And then there's a whole question as to whether or not it could get through the state legislature. I imagine that, you know, if the mayors, the big city mayors really pushed it, it could get through. Then the question comes, what happens when it gets to the governor's desk? And Governor Christie has had a very active veto pen during his tenure as governor. He's vetoed a number of pieces of progressive legislation in different areas. And considering the political inclination and ideological leanings of the governor and of the FOP and the SOA, that is, of the police and the governor, I would be surprised if it got through the legislature if the governor didn't veto. My belief is that he would probably veto it. And then it would be a real question as to whether the Democrats had enough strength in the legislature to override the veto. So, yes, this situation poses some real challenges. And the question that would be facing the People's Organization for Progress is, if the legal battle is lost after all the appeals have been made and the highest courts have been petitioned, if that battle is lost, then the question becomes whether or not we would want to continue on with the police review board that does not have subpoena power and investigatory power. And this is something that we have discussed in our organization. We haven't come to any conclusions, but, you know, we kind of anticipated all of this. I mean, if you're in the community and you're in there long enough, you know the lay of the land, you know how the institutions work, you know how people who are in leadership positions work, you can anticipate some things. So we were kind of anticipating this, and we've already begun discussing whether or not we would maintain a representative on the review board if it doesn't have subpoena power.
Yes, because by maintaining a representative on a board that you believe would not be effective without that kind of power, you'd be legitimizing a, well, what's been described as a toothless agency.
You're using my own words. Yes. And it's a real serious question. I know the mayor, based on some conversations we've had, I know he would like the review board to continue even if it doesn't have subpoena power and investigatory power. That's what the mayor wanted. The mayor, you know, I consider him a friend, you know, and I respect what he wants, but, you know, what he wants to do and what POP may have to do may end up being the same thing, or it may end up not being the same thing.
And, of course, a police community review board by whatever name with subpoena power is not the be-all and end-all of controlling police abuse. New York, as you've pointed out often, has subpoena power, and we see what kind of things happen on those streets.
Right. New York has had a police review board with subpoena power for almost half a century, and some of the worst incidents of police brutality have occurred while New York has had this police review board in place. The greatest weapon in the fight against police brutality is not a police review board. It's an organized and mobilized community that's able to bring sustained pressure against institutions and systems that oppress our communities. And that does include the police. So, you know, while on the one hand it would be lamentable that we couldn't participate or couldn't have the review board that we wanted, on the other hand, we are compelled to step up our efforts to fight police brutality on the streets and in the neighborhoods of the communities where we have branches of the People's Organization for Progress. And that goes not only for POP, that goes for, you know, everybody that wants to fight police brutality. The best weapon we have is our ability to organize and mobilize against police repression.
Yes, and organizations that can put pressure by taking it to the streets and potentially disrupting operations can create problems for mayors, even mayors they're friendly with.
Yes, and it would be unfortunate if it had to be that way, but we have to keep fighting. We don't do this because we don't have anything else to do. We don't do this because it's a hobby. We do this because we're compelled to do it, because the people in our community are being shot, are being killed, are being unjustly arrested, are being incarcerated without just cause, are having their civil rights violated and their human rights violated on a daily basis. And those of us who are seen as advocates for the community, the people come to us. We don't go like door to door, knocking on doors. Have you had a case of police brutality today? Or we don't chase ambulances. You know, somebody was shot over here. Let's run down there and try and do something. No. People know that the People's Organization for Progress meet once a week at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. And I can guarantee you that no less than twice a month, a family or an individual from a family will show up to talk about a family member that's been killed or shot or unjustly treated by the police and request the help of our organization. And this, I'm sure this goes for the other organizations that are in communities, in our community and in other communities throughout the United States who are fighting against police brutality. We do this because the police demonstrate again and again that they are an instrument of repression in our community and that we have to fight against unjust repression, against the violation of our constitutional and our human rights.
This whole process that you outlined, going past the court decision, but then a fight in the legislature and a possible veto, even if you're successful in the legislature, by the governor, all this could take literally years. Do you anticipate staying on that board without subpoena power all that time for it to exhaust the process?
No, I don't. No, I don't. And like I said, we're going to see the legal fight out. We're going to see that through, hoping for the best that the court, because the mayor was pretty clever in terms of how he imbued this particular board with that power. What he did is that he made a permanent member of the review board the city's internal auditor. It might be Inspector General. That person has subpoena power and investigatory power conferred by the state of New Jersey. Any municipality, any large municipality could set that kind of office up because the role of that office is to see that governing agencies are acting in a legal and responsible way and are carrying out their missions. So by placing the IA or the IG for the city of Newark on the police review board, that staff person can use the power that they already have to subpoena individuals and to investigate, officially investigate, instances of police brutality. And if the corporate counsel for the city of Newark can make a strong argument that this was in fact legal, that this is in keeping with the laws of the state of New Jersey, then the convincing argument is made, then perhaps the judge will rule favorably. And so we're going to see that legal process through. And then we will make a determination at that point as to how we will move forward.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
Street protests continue in Haiti, where all three of the nation's largest political parties charge yet another election has been rigged. The U.S.-backed candidate, Jovenel Moïse, supposedly won a phenomenal 55% of the vote, while Maurice Narcisse, the candidate of Fanmi Lavalas, the party of former President Jean Bertrand Aristide, was allocated less than 10% of the vote. Observers point out that if Moïse was so popular, his supporters should be dancing in the streets. But instead, the streets are full of protesters. Pierre Labassier of the Haiti Action Committee has just returned from Haiti. We asked him what he thought about Moïse being given 55% of the vote.
Oh, it's totally unbelievable. Totally unbelievable. I was in Haiti observing the election. And there is no way from what I'd observed, I could see that Jovenel Moïse winning this election. And even at the crazy percentage of 55, that's completely false. I didn't notice any jubilation in the streets or any outpouring of support, because 55%, that's a lot of people. And you would have seen all kinds of demonstrations, as you mentioned earlier, everywhere. But I didn't see that. Basically, you had some of his supporters, you know, tiny group having fun from what it was reported in Pétionville. But in other neighborhoods, you didn't see anything. And it wasn't this kind of big, huge numbers either. But by contrast, that very night, the buzz was in the air that something had gone on. These elections were stolen. And so by the very next day, people were in the streets demonstrating. And they were demonstrating in huge numbers, and those demonstrations haven't stopped.
And what has the reaction of the security services been?
Oh, it's been brutal. It's been very brutal. The Haitian police, the UN occupation forces, who supervises and trains the Haitian police, first, they've been opposed to people demonstrating. They tried to block the demonstration, seizing the sound system, shooting tear gas and rubber bullets and live bullets at people, arresting people, illegally trying to break up any demonstration. So the people turned out anyway, and they challenged the police. They challenged the UN occupation force. They said they have a right to demonstrate. The Haitian constitution gives them that right. They said these elections were stolen elections. They are not going to accept them. And so people took to the streets and haven't stopped. In response, the repressive police force and the UN forces have done, they have attacked the neighborhood of La Saline. La Saline is a neighborhood, impoverished working class community. But the people know that they had voted for Dr. Narcisse, and she had been there several times. And she's very popular in that neighborhood. At one in the morning, when people are sleeping, they actually attacked the neighborhood, lobbing tear gas at people. As a result, three babies were suffocated by the tear gas. Three babies died. And the shame of it is that you didn't see that anywhere in the international press or even in the local Haitian corporate media.
And that is a neighborhood that has been attacked repeatedly since the coup and before the coup by various repressive governments and United Nations soldiers.
Precisely. And also in Delma 2 the same day, and this happened on November 29th, there is a video that shows the police attacking the neighborhood. We are talking about early morning hours, like 9 a.m., 10 a.m., and still they turned out in huge numbers to join the main demonstration that was taking place. Because in Haiti, that's what happens. Different neighborhoods come in and join the main demonstration. People were clapping for them because they were like heroes, man. Those young men, young women, old and young, and everybody was coming out, and they came out despite the repression.
And yet, Maryse Narcisse, the candidate for Fanmi Lavalas, which is Jean-Bertrand Aristide's party, supposedly won less than 10% of the vote. This is a party that has racked up in excess of 60% of the vote in free and fair elections in the past.
Oh, yes, traditionally. And they are forever more popular now than ever before. And you see, what strikes people is that throughout the whole campaign period, and even before that, Caravan of Dignity, it chronicles every day of the campaign, the many cities in different parts, all 10 departments of Haiti. The Famille Lavalas political organization went through them with Dr. Narcisse. They didn't bust people. It was the local communities who turned out. You would see huge crowds. It's as if they want to make people believe all of a sudden, on election day, everybody stayed home. Nobody went to vote. Nobody voted for Dr. Narcisse. Actually, she got 8.5% that they gave her of the vote. It's so ridiculous that even in communities, in neighborhoods like Cité Soleil, Jovenel Moïse won over Fanmi Lavalas. I was there on Friday. The elections was for Sunday, Saturday being a no campaigning day. And huge crowds, I marched to Cité Soleil with the crowd. It was unbelievable how many people were out there. So they want us to believe that on election day, nobody voted for Fanmi Lavalas, or very few, and they gave the whole thing to Jovenel Moïse. They gave their vote. No, and people from Cité Soleil, they've been coming out into the streets. One of the untold stories is that the security forces, the Haitian police and the UN, they've been blocking people in Cité Soleil, trying to prevent them from coming out to join the demonstration. A lot of tear gas, lots of beatings, lots of people being arrested. I mean, the repression has been horrible, but still people are turning out.
So who fixed the election and how did they do it?
Well, as somebody who has observed it and looked at various things going on in Haiti, it was the Haitian Electoral Council, the Provisional Council, the CEP, fixed it with the help of the UN and the active support of the US, France, Canada, the usual. Allied with, you have the Haitian elite, the business community in Haiti. They're all involved in this, but they needed Haitian faces. Jovenel Moïse is a perfect puppet for them to have as the candidate of that group. And then you have the CEP, the Provisional Electoral Council. It's all Haitian, of course, nine of them. And they were very involved in this, with the UN coordinating the operations. One name that keeps popping up also is Tonio Sola, maybe one on the first name, of the Sola group. His name pops up quite a bit because he's the campaign coordinator for Jovenel Moïse, as he was the campaign coordinator for Martelly. This fellow had actually worked on John McCain's campaign, and they charge a lot of money for their services. And he also participated in the stolen elections in Mexico that took place there, that the Mexican people had refused to accept. And so that's a man with very big connections. You have to have big money in order to have his services. So this is the kind of clique that operated this whole concocted elections in Haiti. But one of the things is that the people of Haiti were, they told me they expected these guys would try to steal the elections. It's not as if they did not expect it. They expected it because they know the cast of characters and they have done it before. But they were determined to challenge them. They were determined to stand up, to turn out, to vote, despite all of the tricks that they played, such as voter registration cards, playing tricks with those, such as moving without telling people the voting centers, so places where you had voted the last time and you expect traditionally to vote, they moved them, and nobody knows. People showing up to vote, not finding their names on the voter rolls, or after people protest, let's say if you live in one city, then your name ends up, you're supposed to vote in another city. I met a man, he had to go vote 150 miles away on the day that he showed up to vote, anything and everything. But despite all of that, people voted, and they voted overwhelmingly.
Well, yes, the Haitian people have challenged and partially nullified previous rigged elections, but what is the strategy for the next step?
Well, the next step, from what I know, people are saying, just like the elections of 2015, they did not accept them. They forced them to be annulled. They said these will have to be annulled. They won't accept those results. They said the true results are there. So what Famille Valas is doing, has been doing, is a dual strategy. The strategy is there are many laws in the books in Haiti. They said as if Haiti has no laws. That's not true. There is quite a body of laws in Haiti in regards to these situations. And so Famille Valas, the strategy that they are pursuing, that Dr. Marie Narcisse has said, one is the legal strategy, but they know that the legal strategy will not succeed without streets, the streets being filled with people. So it's both mobilization and legally challenging these results. I myself, I learned a lot watching them, listening to them challenging these through the official channels, to the legal channels. I didn't know we had so many laws that regulated these things. So the CEP people, meaning the Electoral Council people, and a number of these are clearly being shown to the general public to be people who are acting outside the law, to be outlaws. And one of them, his name is Carlos Hercule, is the vice president of the CEP. And I believe yesterday, during one of the court, electoral court sessions, he was forced to say that, yes, the law says this, but I've decided otherwise. And people were like, whoa, it's coming out very strong. But today, which is December 16th, is the 26th anniversary of the first free, fair, democratic elections in Haiti that saw President Aristide being elected overwhelmingly, 67% of the vote. There was a huge demonstration with people saying, no, we will not, as a people, accept stolen elections. These things must end. We must stop them. And when, as people are rising, there is quite a machine of propaganda. Because I speak to family members, I speak to friends, and when most of the radio stations and the TV stations in Haiti are in the hands of the Haitian elite, which have financed this kind of mayhem, which have financed these stolen elections, they work on people psychologically to make you doubt what your eyes are telling you is the truth, or to make others who haven't been to Haiti or who are listening to these radio stations doubt that maybe these guys might be right, or Jovenel might have 55%, because it's such a psychological operation being conducted by the UN. You have the U.S. media, particularly the New York Times, already calling Jovenel Moïse president-elect. The number of governments in Latin America, to their shame, some of them claiming to be leftists or socialists, are saying, sending congratulatory notes to Jovenel Moïse when most political parties in Haiti are contesting these elections, calling them stolen, and are participating in demonstrations. So it's shameful that you see they are dancing to the tune of the State Department and the ultra-right wing in the U.S., which is calling the shots in Haiti. So that's what's going on right now, and the people are determined that they are not going to let this go through. They are determined. One of the things that goes on in Haiti is that the connections for the people of Haiti and elections is very strongly established, because people have had the people's government in power before, the Lavalas government. The streets were clean. There were programs put in place for education, where schools were subsidized. Most schools that were built in Haiti were built during that democratic period, that 10-year period, when President Aristide and Préval, before he betrayed the people, were in office. So most schools were built during that time. You had beautiful houses, good housing, affordable housing, that impoverished working-class people could pay, and eventually after 10 or 15 years, the house would belong to them. I mean, I visited some of them, gorgeous. Not the kind of tombs that Martelly has built, you know, just four walls and all those kinds of stuff. But these are really good houses. And this was at a time when there was economic sabotage, economic blockade of the government of President Aristide. Those were being built. You had a lunch program for school children. You had transportation programs, the dignity buses, they were called, to provide transportation for kids to go into school. So it was such a powerful movement in the country that the people remember very, very well. And so ever since the coup of 2004, people have realized, they have seen how they have been taken away, how these steps towards a better life, better living conditions, how these have been taken away from them, what the reality is for them right now. So they know that with these elections, they could put a team in office that would really be working to make sure that their lives, that there is improvement in their lives, and farmers would get access to seeds, access to fertilizer, and people would find jobs in the country. Right now, a lot of the construction work is being done by teams that are brought in from outside the country. So instead of people in the country finding these jobs, but those jobs are being brought in, companies, foreign companies, get those juicy contracts, and then they bring in everybody, a whole crew with them. And the people of Haiti who are skilled, who could do these jobs, are not getting them. So a whole host of problems. For example, people who are living in many of the impoverished communities, in the poor neighborhoods, any little rain in Haiti they get flooded, their home gets flooded, and they have to spend the night holding their children to shelter them from being in that filthy water. The reason being that those drainage canals are not being drained. The local mayors were appointed by Martelly. And so many of these people, it's corruption. The money goes into their pocket. People are not being paid to clean the drainage canals or the sewers. Garbage is not being picked up. So you have tons of garbage, mountains of garbage that clog the sewer system. And so any little rain, the water backs up in people's homes. So this is the kind of stuff that people are experiencing. And that's why they say, we need a change. And it's not an abstract thing. It's concrete. And people refuse to accept that they have to spend another 5 years dealing with this, the child of this occupation, Jovenel Moïse, who's a partner of Martelly, and all the misdeeds that they are doing. And finally, people are saying enough of this occupation. They want to impose on us a leadership that will continue this occupation. These people who are occupying Haiti, and I'm in the UN, and countries like France, Canada, the US, Brazil, and so many others, they call themselves the core group. Well, Haiti, the people of Haiti have been, for the past, it's going to be now 13 years. It started in 2004, February, and it's going to be 13 years of this occupation. The economy of the people of Haiti has suffered tremendously. The economic conditions have worsened, more than worsened, and under the occupation by these very rich countries. And all that they do is steal Haiti's resources.
Pierre Lebossier of the Haiti Action Committee.
The people of East Aleppo in Syria have finally been liberated. After 4 years of occupation by U.S.-backed Islamic jihadists, Bashar al-Shihabi is an independent member of the Syrian parliament from Aleppo. He's also head of the Syrian Chamber of Industry. Shihabi was interviewed by Patrick Henningsen of the Sunday Wire program on Alternate Current Radio. Shihabi has been greeting his countrymen recently freed from the jihadists.
They all confirmed that they were captured as hostages, as human shields for 4.5 years by Al-Qaeda gangs. Al-Qaeda gangs, the same ones that we saw in Afghanistan earlier. Same style of governance, same style of rule, same style of religious courts, of type of Islamic jihadist rule. Unfortunately, we were not able to free them before. The liberation process just started 2 weeks ago, and we were able to, with their help actually, we were able to liberate more than 95% of the eastern parts of Aleppo only in 2 weeks. And now the operation still continues to for the remainder of the 5% remaining parts of East Aleppo.
And tell us, Faris, you've seen this story from the beginning. Tell us what happened. Bring us back to 2012, how this started in Aleppo, because there's, in the West, the theme that they play in our Western media, our party line, as it were, in Washington, is that there were peaceful, democratic reform protesters, and the government came and clamped down, and these freedom fighters took up arms and defended half of the East Aleppo from the evil government forces.
Of course, the same story we heard in Afghanistan, the freedom fighters turned out to be Al-Qaeda fighters later on. The same story everywhere we see. We were there. I mean, we lived through it minute by minute, day by day. There were no protests in Aleppo. Only few people protested in Aleppo, a city of 3 million people. At the peak of the protests, no more than 10,000 people out of 3 million took to the street. It was peaceful protest. Mainly, they were people not from Aleppo. No one cracked them down. No one killed them. No one committed any atrocities against them. And in 24 hours, that was July 22nd, 2012, in 24 hours, we were conquered by outside forces, came from rural areas, gathered by the Turkish intelligence, by NATO intelligence, people from all over the world, jihadis, all of them, Islamists, all of them, by the name of the Tawheed Brigade. And the leader of the Tawheed Brigade His name is Abdul Qadir Saleh. You can dig him up. You can Google him. He used to be one of Zarqawi's assistants in Iraq before. All these jihadi factions gathered together in one group called Tawheed Brigade, and they conquered our city. And they said clearly, and I quote, they said clearly, I think it was LA Times or some American newspaper when they interviewed them days after they conquered Aleppo, they said clearly that we came here, they said that, we came here to punish Aleppo for not participating in our revolution and to transfer the revolution by force to inside Aleppo. So they came with the purpose of punishing Aleppo, of robbing Aleppo, and of destroying Aleppo, and of turning this city, this peaceful city, this working city, this middle-class city, into a hot zone. And they were successful in doing so for 4.5 years, unfortunately. We were all shocked at the beginning. We blamed our army because there was no army in Aleppo at the time in 2012, only police stations and some security personnel, that's it, protecting a big city. There was no army, there were no tanks, there were no soldiers, no planes, no helicopters, nothing. And they used heavy weapons and they conquered our city, and they were able to conquer 70% of Aleppo in 2012, which led to the escape of 1.5 million citizens from these parts of eastern parts of Aleppo in 2012. This is something also that NATO media lies about. 1.5 million people came to the western parts of Aleppo after this brutal occupation that took place in July of 2012. And we harbored in the western parts of Aleppo around 500,000 of them. And the rest, they went, some went to the coastal area, some went to Damascus, and some went outside. And another lie we've been hearing recently, that they said that there are 300,000 people in the eastern Aleppo. It turns out, after now, we are on the ground, no more than 100,000 people are there. So also, this is another lie that we've been hearing.
And they also said there's 100,000 children. They said this in the UN. I heard this from the U.S. delegation, the British, of course, in the UN. 100,000 children trapped in East Aleppo. And most of the time, they don't even say East Aleppo, Ferris. They just say under siege in Aleppo. So the impression the Western public gets is that the entire city is being sieged by the Syrian army and the Russians, which is not true.
Exactly. The actual reality that the eastern parts of Aleppo, they were the largest hostage crisis in history. They took these civilians hostages. And what we are seeing now, the liberation process, is the largest hostage-breaking release commando work in the history. Because this is a big area. We're talking about 45 square kilometer area. And they held 100,000 people hostage for 4 years. They did not allow them to leave when we set up the corridors. We set up 6 safety corridors 3 times throughout 3 months. And every time we tell them, please let the civilians go. You can go yourself. We can put you in the reconciliation process. There is a presidential pardon. You can lay down your arm and become a citizen again. They refused. They refused and they refused. And they shot at many civilians who tried to escape. And just yesterday, a family came to me and told me half of their members were shot, killed, as they were fleeing from the Qaeda gangs by the name of Nusra and Zinki and other names that we hear on the news.
That was Faris Shihabi speaking from Aleppo, Syria.
Last month at the Schomburg Center in New York's Harlem, MOVE activist Ramona Africa appeared on a program organized by Inside the Activist Studio. Ramona Africa is a survivor of the mass incarceration and killing of MOVE members by Philadelphia police. Robin Spencer is one of the organizers of Inside the Activist Studio. Spencer was interviewed by Black Agenda Report producer Kyle Fraser.
Inside the Activist Studio is one of the key projects of the campaign to bring Mumia home. The goal is really to build upon Mumia Abu-Jamal's history and current role as the voice of the voiceless. It's really to build on the revolutionary journalistic tradition that he represents that stretches back to people like Ida B. Wells, and provide information to our communities, information that's relevant to their understanding of the radical history of the Black Freedom Movement, and information that's relevant to their understanding about contemporary politics and give them a vision for the future. So the goal is to gather information about one particular historic figure and then interview that person after doing intensive research in a public forum in a way that highlights their contribution to resistance traditions.
As a historian, what do you think is the significance of this form of documenting history?
Well, I think three things. One is that it really does embody living history, right? When Ramona Africa sits there and she's being interviewed and she's talking about the incredible things that she did in her life and the very ordinary ways in which she grew up as a typical young woman at her time, it really makes, I think, the audience look around in their communities and see the elders that are there as carriers of histories, of struggle, and perhaps would inspire someone to spend time learning and speaking to elders about what it was like to live through this period. This period was not hundreds of years ago. There are people in our communities who can tell us about what it was like to be part of that historical moment, and that will help us now, because oftentimes when we think about people like Malcolm X or even Dr. King, Fannie Lou Hamer, it's almost as if they lived a long time ago, right? But we have people like Ramona Africa. We have people like Sekou Odinga who can report back on what it was like and who can really talk to us about the type of future that they saw when they were struggling in the 60s, because we're living in that future right now. The second thing is that I think watching Inside the Activist Studio should challenge people to think critically about the way in which news and information is brought to them by mainstream sources. In Inside the Activist Studio, we're really doing investigative journalism. We're doing oral history. We're doing it in a way that's entertaining and engaging, and we're doing it in a way that's sort of people-powered. Right, even the whole process of creating the finished product represents what we hope the finished product to do. So it should hopefully demand that the audience sitting there become less satisfied with the mainstream news sources that are feeding them poison, that are telling them what's news and what's important when there's so many other things going on in the world that oftentimes get swept under the table. So it's also, I think, a critical intervention into what and how people consume information, and a radical challenge to that by presenting an alternative. Third is the goal of creating a culture of resistance. So Ramona Africa in particular, Sekou Odinga, our first interviewee, incredibly inspiring people. Right? Ramona Africa left us with a charge. From the water that we drink, to the way we treat the animals, to the way we treat the earth, to our acquiescence to police power, to how we treat the people in our lives. She brought all of that to bear, moved the MOVE organization, challenged and questioned all of those things, from not just your political way of life, but just your personal practices. So Ramona Africa left us with a challenge to do more, to struggle harder, to incorporate more into how we see struggle, to look at our food critically, to look at our water critically, our relationship to the earth, as well as our relationship to the state, or to the system, as MOVE calls it. So the goal is really to create this culture of resistance, and Ramona Africa left the audience, I think, with specific things that they could do, whether it be supporting the struggle to free political prisoners, especially Mumia Abu-Jamal, who the MOVE organization has been so central in focusing on, reminding us about the MOVE family that is still incarcerated today from trumped-up charges and all of the illegalities of the past. They're still suffering under that, the repercussions of that, paying with their very freedom. So it's really a call to arms, and not arms in the traditional sense, but maybe even just a mental arming, a political arming, a readiness, and a more critical eye is hopefully what the audience left the auditorium at the Schomburg feeling. And hopefully they will continue to support the different organizations that are out there that are still fighting in the struggle, old and new.
Ramona Africa spoke of the necessity of sustained resistance to to what MOVE refers to as the system. What was the significance to you of that insight, especially given this current political climate?
Well, it was very inspiring to me. I felt like she basically talked about the horrors that she experienced. I mean, when she described inside the MOVE bombing, you know, it was riveting, it was angering, it was tragic, it was so many emotions. I think anyone who was listening to that, to imagine that her entire family was killed, you know, except for her and one other survivor. And what did it mean? I think today we talk about PTSD and trauma and emotional health and all of that. You just think, well, how did she survive? Would have been so easy to give up or to fall into some emotional hole. Who could blame somebody who'd gone through that? But she was strong enough and supported enough that as the MOVE organization rebuilt outside of the walls, she was able to sustain herself inside of the walls. And I think that's definitely a story of longevity. And to come out and to experience the ways in which a lot of the principles that MOVE lives by has become mainstream, have become commodified deeply and almost unavailable now for the average person, the person of color in the communities. A lot of things that MOVE did were on the cutting edge. And the irony of also seeing that movement, I think, would make a MOVE member feel doubly committed to the rightness of their cause. Because now some of the things that they proclaimed or embraced have become mainstream, have become commodified. And not that was their goal, but it speaks to the powerful nature of the radical critique and that people want alternatives. And I think MOVE's ability to provide an alternative over time, despite repression, despite incarceration, despite murder, is just incredibly astounding. So I think for this political moment, it gives one motivation because it could feel very bleak right now. We're in the wake of the election of Donald Trump. And as he selects people that he's going to surround himself with and they're going to play key roles in government, there's a lot of fear as to what kind of policy program is going to be facing this country after Inauguration Day. But I think MOVE gives us a long trajectory of stuff, struggle, and lets us know that we're going to be all right. The movement is going to continue. It may seem new, but there's nothing new that the state can do in a way, because they did everything to the MOVE family, including dropping a military bomb on them, and they're still standing and growing. So it's a very powerful message that she embodies and her history embodies.
And you mentioned as part of the aim of Inside the Activist Studio, building a culture of resistance. Besides watching the interview of Ramona Africa, how can people get involved in this culture of resistance?
Well, the MOVE organization is still alive and thriving. Right? One can support the MOVE organization, the MOVE political prisoners, the larger struggle to free political prisoners and prisoners of war. I think one of the things that came out during the interview was just the humanity of political prisoners. So certainly picking up a pen and a piece of paper and writing to them, supporting them, sending them a postcard or a card, would also be one way of getting involved and kind of supporting what Inside the Activist Studio is trying to do. It's really about building community, and it's really about increasing the knowledge that is out there to build critical thinking, to have people really sit down, as Ramona Africa talks about in her life, and think about the illegalities. What's illegal? What's legal? How do we use these words? We hear them on the news all the time. What do they really mean? What have they meant in the history of this country? So it really, I think, invites us into just shifting our perspective. And I think that's what we're really trying to do with Inside the Activist Studio. But remember, it's never an individual act. It may start with the eye, but Ramona Africa was part and is part of an organization. Sekou Odinga was and is part of an organization. And the campaign to bring Mia home, we are an organization. It's important to be organized and not just feel like you're an individual doing an individual act, but to build community. Today, people will talk about hanging around or doing Netflix and chilling. You know, this is an alternative to that. Gather people together, watch this video, and discuss the political future.
The nation's best-known political prisoner called in from a Pennsylvania prison to introduce Ramona Africa to the audience at Harlem Schomburg Center.
Hey, y'all. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Welcome to Inside the Activist Studio. Tonight, here at Harlem's historic Schomburg Center, you'll meet a living slice of history. Her name is Ramona Africa, Minister of Communications of the Revolutionary Move Organization. Remember the infamous police bombing of the Move House on May 13, 1985? Well, some of you remember that. Ramona was in that house when police and a copter dropped a bomb on that building. When she was a young student at Temple, she planned on becoming a lawyer. Once she saw what was really happening in court to Move members, she dropped those plans quick. When she came and saw not legal theory, but legal tricks, legal repression, legalized brutality against Move people, against Black people, against poor people, well, to her credit, she didn't turn away. She didn't run away. She stood her ground. Hey, don't let me talk about it. Let her talk about it, right? Welcome to Ramona Africa, Minister of Communications, the Move Organization.
So you grew up in West Philly in the 1950s and 60s. So what was it like to grow up at that time in that place?
I remember fairly early in my ability to be able to see what was going on in the 60s, early 60s. I remember the first example of police murder that I was ever aware of. It was a young Muslim brother named Winston 3X Hood, and the cops had stopped him, handcuffed him behind his back, and blew his brains out. That was the first example, and I have never forgotten it. I remember hearing about the Panthers from the beginning, you know. I remember hearing about different people like Malcolm X, Robert Williams, and they fascinated me. I ended up reading books about them. The problem is I read about them and I was in accord with them, but it wasn't really real to me. You know, it was something I read about, heard about, and gravitated to. But it wasn't really real to me because I didn't experience it. You know, I read and heard about various other examples of police brutality, police murder, you know. And while I sympathized with the families of, you know, people that had been murdered and I knew it was wrong. I knew injustice existed, racism existed. It wasn't something that I personally experienced. And I think that was the missing piece of the puzzle, because you can know about something, mm-hmm. but it hits home when you experience it personally.
Well, there's similarities in the experiences you describe with those of Ramsey Orta. We know he's the only person to have been imprisoned after the police strangulation of Eric Garner. Mm. There's the example of Amarlee Graham, who was killed in his Bronx home in front of his mother and grandmother, and it was his mother and his grandmother who were then detained and questioned for hours at the police station. Can you comment on the meaning of this for you and today?
All it really does is open my eyes even more to just how treacherous those running this system are. I mean, they have no shame. No shame at all. When I think about Veronica Bowers, Leonard Peltier, I mean, the case of Leonard Peltier just really makes my blood boil that these, you know, people running this country have the audacity to call Leonard a murderer when they have slaughtered Leonard's people into virtual extinction and they're going to call him a murderer. You know, when I think about this 15-year hit that Sundiata Okoli just got, and he's 80 this week, you know? I mean, the audacity of these people running this system to get in our face and call us criminal? We would be criminal if we didn't resist these sick-ass misfits. Then we would be criminals.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.